Tehran's top negotiator says good progress has so far been made at the talks in Vienna over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. Iranians remember their national hero, General Soleimani, 2 years after the U.S. assassinated the top commander. And Moscow says it wants legally binding guarantees from U.S.-led NATO that it won't move eastwards. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal have paused their talks until Monday when they're returning to the negotiating team in the Austrian capital. Iran's top negotiator says the removal of anti-Iran sanctions has so far been the main focus of the 8th round of the Vienna talks.
The issue of sanctions removal was the main focus of the talks. Iran and the other side continued their negotiations on multiple issues, including a number of sessions on the verification of sanctions removal. The meetings were attended by both the coordinator of the Joint Commission of the JCPOA and the European side. Also, on the issue of verification, Iran held separate sessions with the coordinator of the Joint Commission and the three European signatories. There was also some correspondence between the two sides on the issue of sanctions removal. Good progress was made during the first days of the 8th round. We hope more serious work will get underway on the issue of sanctions removal once our foreign interlocutors return to the negotiations after the New Year holidays.
Well, we've reached out to our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lizgi, for the latest update on the talks between Iran and the P4 plus one group. Let's take a listen at what she has to say.
We are hearing a lot of various, of course, information and positions being announced. Earlier, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Onyanov, was speaking to reporters here. And he said that he believes that there's steady progress being made, and that, in his words, he said even those sides which previously were skeptical about these talks now concede and acknowledge that progress is being made. And he was saying that the sides are all agreeing that they have to have this deal as soon as possible. And in his assessment, it is doable, he said, in the first half of February, maybe a little bit later or earlier. We can't say for sure, but he says he believes that it is possible by then to do this. Also, a source very close to the negotiations who was speaking to the media in the tent here was also saying that there is a good business-like atmosphere in the talks and that these talks are progressing, although the substance, he said, is good. But that source was saying that maybe the momentum needs still to be built up. So some Western sources and sources close to the European side of the discussion still insisting on this issue of time and this pressure when it comes to timing, saying that we need to speed up these talks, we need to be able to reach an agreement within weeks, and saying that with the current pace that the talks have, they're concerned if that is possible. But at the same time, acknowledging that indeed progress is being made, because the two issues that were fundamentally important for the especially new Iranian team here and were proposed by Mr. Barghari, verification and guarantees, are now being discussed in the format of being included in the final document. So these are issues that are being drafted. So these, both verification and guarantees, we're hearing from sources, are issues that, the tricky issues that still remain. Because when it comes to verification, there are still questions on how Iran, the other sides, can verify that the Americans are going to effectively remove the sanctions. How is this going to happen? By who, etc.? And also when it comes to guarantees, how is it going to be possible to include, for instance, a clause in the final document to give Iran the assurance that it needs that the U.S., once it withdraws, once it goes back into the deal and removes the sanctions, is not going to impose them again, is not going to withdraw again.
The Iranians have gathered in the city of Ray to commemorate the second martyrdom anniversary of top Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in 2020 in an American drone strike in Iraq. Yusuf Jalali reports.
This gathering in Iran's town of Shahr-e-Ray is a tribute to a man who's known as the father of national security in Iran, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. A few days ahead of the second anniversary of his assassination, Iranian people and senior officials gathered to commemorate him and mourn his loss.
General Soleimani is no longer with us, but his legacy will continue across the generations to come. His assassination is a huge miscalculation on the part of the U.S. He was an influential asset in the region, and his assassination led to the humiliating ouster of American troops from Iraq and then Afghanistan.
General Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was killed in 2020 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism in our region. So by assassinating him, the U.S. sought to dispose of him to allow the terrorists to roam freely in the region to serve the interests of the American government.
By assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. thought in vain that it will stop his anti-terror activities. But in fact, Soleimani is still alive in the hearts of millions of Iranians who will continue his path stronger than ever.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that resulted in the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. His efforts made him known as the nemesis of the terrorists in the region. In 2020, millions of people in Iraq and Iran took part in his funeral ceremony to pay tribute to him and bid him farewell.
2 years into the incident, Iranians still mourn the loss of General Soleimani. They say they will not forget his endeavors in the fight against terrorism, something which earned him the title of a national hero and the guarantor of regional security. Yusuf Jalali from the town of Ray.
Meanwhile, Iranians also hold nationwide rallies to mark December the 30th, on the 12th anniversary of huge demonstrations staged across the country in support of the Islamic establishment. Demonstrators took to the streets in the capital and in other cities carrying placards and chanting slogans in solidarity with the government. In 2009, two defeated presidential candidates disputed election results over alleged vote rigging. Well, the allegations were dismissed by authorities as baseless, but the defeated candidates urged their supporters to take to the streets. The protests, which turned into deadly riots, eventually came to an end after millions marched across the country to condemn the unrest. This day falls on December the 30th and has since been marked as an important day on Iran's political calendar. More news from Iran this hour. Iran has successfully sent three research payloads into space using a domestically produced satellite launch rocket. Iranian Defense Ministry says the Simorgh satellite carrier rocket launched the research devices to an altitude of 470 kilometers. It also says the objectives of the launch have been fulfilled. According to the ministry, the development of the Simorgh satellite launch rocket, as well as the Imam Khomeini space station, have been key projects in Iran's space industry. The country has already sent other satellites into space using two domestically made carriers dubbed Safir and Qasid. Moving on to other news now. This hour, Moscow says it seeks security guarantees from the West amid rising tensions over Ukraine. Well, this comes ahead of security talks between Russia and NATO member states scheduled for early January.
During the talks, we will seek firm legal guarantees of Russia's security from the U.S. side, namely that NATO will not move eastwards and that weapons systems threatening Russia will not be deployed near our borders.
Maria Zakharova says Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his U.S. counterpart will lead security talks in Geneva on January the 10th. Russia will subsequently hold talks with NATO, as well as other European countries. The negotiations come as the United States and NATO accuse Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow has strongly dismissed the allegation and expressed concern over what it calls the West's rearming of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden are also scheduled to hold a phone call on Thursday. Meanwhile, Taiwan remains a major source of dispute between China and the United States. Now Beijing warns that Washington is at risk of paying, quote, an unbearable price because of its actions over the island. The Chinese foreign minister says the U.S. is pushing Taiwan towards independence, warning that the policy will propel the island into an extremely dangerous situation. Wang Yi also says Taiwan has no alternative but to reunify with the mainland. China regards Taiwan as part of its sovereign territory. While the U.S. recognizes only one China, it's been providing Taipei with armed support. And President Joe Biden has even approved a bill that allocates around $7 billion for missions to counter China in the Pacific and to support Taiwan.
China has harshly warned Chinese Taipei against making moves towards independence. Beijing says it will take drastic measures if the self-governed island crosses red lines. Chinese officials say provocation by separatist forces in Taiwan and, quote, external intervention could intensify in coming months. Foreign ministry officials say China is willing to try its utmost to seek peaceful reunification with Taipei, but would act if any red lines on independence were crossed.
Well, crossing the red lines for China would mean that Taiwan would declare independence. And it would be, in reality, would be against Taiwan's constitution. In order to change Taiwan's constitution, it would need us all to pass a referendum, which would need to have an approval of 75% of the legislative chamber. So at this stage, Taiwan's declaring independence, it's very unlikely.
Earlier in December, China's foreign minister stressed the need for Taipei to be reunited with Beijing, saying the self-ruled island is not a chess piece to be used by others. Wang Yi said the root cause of the new round of tensions lies with the island's authority that have attempted to solicit U.S. support for Taiwan independence. He also accused the United States and certain countries of deliberately using Taipei to contain Beijing. The top Chinese diplomat described Taipei's ambitions for independence as perverse actions and said the moves designed to change the status quo undermine peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait and violate the consensus of the international community as well as the basic norms governing international relations. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all the world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S. too recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long courted Taipei in defiance of Beijing.
If you look at the largest companies, Taiwanese companies such as Foxconn and Pegatron, they have most of their workforce in the mainland. So it would be just an economical suicide for Taiwanese just to declare independence. And it's very unlikely. Independence is a planted idea by the U.S., against China and Taiwan's interests.
Taiwan has emerged as a highly sensitive issue in the strained relations between China and the United States. Beijing claims Taiwan as its own territory and has warned separatist forces on the island not to provoke it. And this is where the U.S. comes in. Beijing believes that Washington is influencing Taiwanese groups pushing for independence.
The United States, which backs Taipei's secessionist president, continues to sell weapons to the island in violation of its own stated policy. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Instead, the U.S. had an embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to establish formal ties in a bid to create a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1979, the US gave formal diplomatic recognition to the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. In doing so, Washington recognized the PRC as the sole legal government of China. It also acknowledged Beijing's position that there is only one China and that Taipei is part of it. After the US cut off formal relations with Taipei, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. It has underpinned US ties towards the island ever since.
Well, the US policy regarding Taiwan is what they call a strategic ambiguity. It is officially respecting the One China policy, but in action, the US has clearly been undermining the One China policy by meddling into Taiwanese politics. The US has groomed President Tsai Ing-wen since 2004.
In recent years, the US has made China a top priority. The measure, known as the Pivot to Asia policy, was unveiled during Obama's administration and made East Asia and China in particular a top priority of the US foreign policy. The Trump administration dramatically upped the ante against China. Back in October, US President Joe Biden said the United States would come to Taipei's aid if it were to come under attack from China, claiming it had a commitment to defend the self-ruled island.
So besides that, the US has been investing massively into Taiwanese politics and media through NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is the rebranded name for the CIA.
China blasted the statement, accusing Washington of meddling in Chinese internal affairs. The US and China are also at loggerheads over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea.
Anger is still boiling in Sudan over the October military coup. Security forces have clashed with demonstrators marching on the presidential palace in the capital, Khartoum. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse protesters who called for full civilian rule without any military involvement. Demonstrators also chanted slogans against the military chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who led the coup. Burhan's forces detained Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok for weeks, but later reinstated him. Anti-coup protests have nevertheless continued. Nearly 50 people have been killed by security forces since the military takeover on October the 25th. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Former U.S. prosecutors say if the 6th of January panel finds new evidence about former President Donald Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. We now present you an article written by Peter Shaw. The piece is titled, Legal Experts Say Trump Could Face Charges for Trying to Obstruct Certification of Election. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former prosecutors and other experts say expectation is growing that former U.S. President Donald Trump might face charges for trying to obstruct Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election this year as a House panel collects more evidence into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. Speculation about possible charges against the former U.S. President Donald Trump has been heightened by a recent rhetorical bombshell from Republican Representative and 6th of January panel Vice Chair Liz Cheney, suggesting the House panel is looking at whether Trump broke a law that bars obstruction of official proceedings. Former prosecutors say if the panel finds new evidence about Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. Department of Justice veterans say in varying ways Liz Cheney's comments have been echoed by two other members of the House Select Committee, Republican Adam Kinzinger and Democrat Jamie Raskin, spurring talks of how an obstruction statute could apply to Trump, which would entail the panel making a criminal referral of evidence for the Justice Department to investigate. Former Justice Department officials say Liz Cheney's remarks raising the specter of criminal charges against Donald Trump came twice earlier this month at hearings of the committee. Experts believe the charges could be well-founded given Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January, including incendiary remarks to a rally just before the Capitol attack and failure to act for hours to stop the rioting. Former Department of Justice Inspector General and former prosecutor Michael Bromwich, in a statement to The Guardian, said, "Based on what is already in the public domain, there's powerful evidence that numerous people in and out of government attempted to obstruct, and did obstruct, at least for a while, an official proceeding, that is, the certification of the presidential election." Michael Bromwich added, "That is a crime." Former prosecutors say although a House panel referral of obstruction by Donald Trump would not force the Department of Justice to open a criminal case against him, it could help provide more evidence for one and build pressure on the Justice Department to move forward. Attorney General Merrick Garland has declined to say so far whether his department may be investigating Donald Trump and his top allies already for their roles in the Capitol assault. The panel has amassed significant evidence including more than 30,000 records and interviews with more than 300 people, among whom were some key White House staff. The evidence against Donald Trump himself could include his actions at the Stop the Steal rally not far from the White House, where he urged backers to march to the Capitol and fight like hell, or you're not going to have a country anymore. Donald Trump then resisted multiple pleas for hours from Republicans and others to urge his violent supporters to stop the attack on the Capitol. Recent ruling by Trump-appointed district court judges have supported using the obstruction statute, which federal prosecutors have cited in about 200 cases involving rioters charged by the Department of Justice for their roles in the Capitol assault that injured about 140 police officers and left 5 people dead. Still, experts note that the House panel's mission has been to assemble a comprehensive report of what took place on 6th of January and work on legislation to avoid such assaults on democracy. They caution that any criminal referral to Department of Justice documenting Trump's obstruction of Congress will take time and more evidence to help bolster a Department of Justice investigation. Some Department of Justice veterans say that any referral to Department of Justice by the House panel for a criminal case against Donald Trump and perhaps top allies such as former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, whom the House recently cited for criminal contempt for refusing to be deposed, might also include Trump's aggressive pressuring of federal and state officials before 6th of January to block Joe Biden's election win with baseless charges of fraud. Bromwich stressed that evidence is steadily accumulating that would prove obstruction beyond a reasonable doubt. The ultimate question is who the defendants would be in such an obstruction case. Evidence is growing that, as a matter of law and fact, that could include Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, and other members of Trump's inner circle. Liz Cheney teed up the issue about Trump's potential culpability first at a House panel hearing recently, when she urged that Mark Meadows be held in contempt for refusing to be deposed, and then hit Donald Trump with a rhetorical bombshell. Liz Cheney said, "We know hours passed with no action by the President to defend the Congress and the United States from an assault while we were counting electoral votes. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes?" Liz Cheney's comments about Donald Trump are very precise, including language from the criminal obstruction statute, and she stated that her question is a key one for the panel's legislative task. Democrat Senator Jamie Raskin, too, has told the website Politico that the issue of whether Donald Trump broke the law by obstructing an official proceeding is clearly one of the things on the mind of some of the members of the House committee. Paul Rosenzweig, a former Department of Justice prosecutor who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of former President Bill Clinton, said, "The possibility of obstruction charges is legally valid," noting that the two district judges appointed by Donald Trump have recently said that the statute covers the efforts on 6th of January to stop the electoral count. For instance, Judge Dabney Friedrich, in a recent opinion, rejected the claim for some defendants who were challenging the Department of Justice's view that the 6th of January meeting of Congress fit the legal definition of an official proceeding. Rosenzweig posited that given Donald Trump's various attempts before 6th of January to undermine the election results, a broader conspiracy case may be another option for prosecutors to pursue. Former prosecutors say, should Department of Justice look at broader conspiracy charges, Donald Trump's persistent pressures on Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen and his top deputy for help blocking Joe Biden's election victory would probably be relevant. On one call on 27th of December 2020, Donald Trump pressed Jeffrey Rosen and his deputy to falsely state the election illegal and corrupt, despite the fact that the Department of Justice has not found any evidence of widespread voter fraud. Paul Peltier, a former acting chief of fraud section at Department of Justice, said that Liz Cheney's statements were carefully crafted and obviously based upon evidence the committee had seen. Should Congress ultimately refer the case to Department of Justice for investigation and prosecution, The Department of Justice's investigation would not be limited to a single obstruction charge, but would more likely investigate broader conspiracy charges, potentially involving Donald Trump and other key loyalists. The panel has accelerated its pace recently by sending out dozens of subpoenas for documents and depositions, some to close Donald Trump aides. Mark Meadows has become a central focus of the inquiry, in part over tweets he received on and near the insurrection that are among approximately 9,000 documents he gave the panel, much to Donald Trump's chagrin. As Trump's efforts to thwart the panel from moving forward have had limited success, he has relied on sending out splenetic email attacks, including one recently that read, "The Unselect Committee itself is rigged, stacked with never-Trumpers, Republican enemies, and two disgraced rhinos, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who couldn't get elected dog-catcher in their districts." Despite Donald Trump's angry attacks on the panel, some former prosecutors say that prosecuting Trump, if enough evidence is found to merit charges, is important for the health of American democracy. Former Georgia Attorney General Jay Moore told The Guardian, "I hate to think of a legal system that would allow the most powerful person in the country to go unchallenged when he has abdicated his highest priority, that being to keep American citizens safe. Donald Trump's conduct on that day was not unlike a mob boss."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
On this occasion of Fatimiyah, I would like to discuss how the Lady Fatimatu Zahra, Salamullahi alayha, has saved the Ummah. In other words, Lady Fatimatu Zahra saving the Ummah after the demise of the Prophet. And the Ummah includes all of those who lived at that time all the way up to today. This Ummah of the Prophet all the way until the Day of Judgment. The Ummah of the Holy Prophet has been saved by what the Lady Fatimatu Zahra Salamullahi Alayha did, which led to her shahada. This is what we want to, inshallah, discuss over the course of these three nights. And hopefully she guides us and she's pleased and she forgives the shortcomings that I have in presenting the material. Why? Why is having this want and desire for shahada, for martyrdom, that anyone who reads her story, hears her story, cries for her, will naturally develop a liking towards that, a want towards that. And the more you cry, and the more you connect with her, and the more close you get to her, the more you will want that. Like the great shuhada that wished that they would die the way Fatimatu Zahra did, and they would get shot in their ribs because of their connection to Fatimatu Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. The closer you get, the more you would want that. Why is this savior of the Ummah? The individuals of the Ummah, we said that in order for a person to reach that highest level, there's no other way. Shahada is the way. Martyrdom is the way. The way to leave this world and in the process of leaving, reach the highest level that person can reach is to leave it in the form of shahada. So by creating this, the Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha is bringing so many more people that would otherwise not even know about this, not even have a desire towards this, not have a want for this, because of the love they have for her, what they see of her, this painful thing of a gradual death. See, we have instances of shahada that occur in one day, in one half day, for a few hours, injuries, pains, and so on and so forth, and then shahada. In the case of Fatima al-Zahra, a couple of months of injuries and pains and God knows what until the moment of shahada, melting before the eyes of Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullahi alayhi. If people wouldn't see this in Fatima al-Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet, Sayyidatu Nisa'i al-Alamin, who would want this painful form of death? Who would take steps that would lead to them getting injured? Who would want to take steps that they know the enemies of Islam would put them in the dungeons, would torture them, and they would have to live the rest of their life until their death with those injuries, with those disabilities? Who would want to do that? But you see Fatima al-Zahra, you hear Fatima al-Zahra, you hear Sayyidatu Nisa'il Alameen min al-Awwalina wal-Akhirin, she did this, you cry for her, you desire that, you want that. So all these people who've heard that and have wanted it and have reached it, these are the individuals that Fatima al-Zahra has selected. Brothers, sisters, it's an honor to be one of those selected by Fatima al-Zahra to reach the rank of shahada. One of those selected by Fatima al-Zahra to love and desire martyrdom. It's an honor. It's a privilege that we should ask and beg Allah to give us. Ya Allah, whatever there is in this heart, that when I think of dying in your way, being killed in your way, being tortured in your way, that I feel like I don't want that. Ya Allah, whatever those sins, those veils are, by the right of Fatima al-Zahra, relieve us all of these sins, these limitations, these veils. The individuals from amongst the ummah are saved in that way. But the ummah as the whole is saved. Remember, we said saving is not that, oh, you don't go down the pits of hellfire. Savior is gradational. Saving from every level of shortcoming, every level of naqs, every level of lowness. Being saved from that level and moving above and above and above and excelling further and further. This is also salvation. Salvation isn't, oh, you're either in paradise or you're in hell. And just saving someone from hellfire, from entering hell, and just simply entering paradise, this is salvation. This is saving. No. The ones who are at the lowest level of paradise, to be saved from that and be elevated, that's being saved from being at a lower level of paradise and moving above. This is salvation as well. For the ummah, simply not being deviated entirely is not the only thing that happens with this, although that is the case, I'll explain. If it wasn't for this istishhad, and the istishhad and the martyrdom of her children, the martyrdom itself, if it wasn't for that, the religion would have been deviated. Tashayyu' would have been deviated. Islam would have been deviated. Not just because of their martyrdom right there. Again, the martyrdom has a message for the believers afterwards. That message is calling believers towards shahada, creating a want, a desire for shahada, for martyrdom. If it wasn't for that effect, and if it wasn't for believers taking that, and accepting that, and wanting that, and wanting shahada, and wanting martyrdom, during the centuries after the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra, after the beginning of the minor occultation, after the beginning of the major occultation, all these 10 centuries, more than 10 centuries after the beginning of the major occultation, if it wasn't for that, the religion would have been deviated. That we'll explain. But not only that, not only that, not only did that Shahada and the effect of it on the others after her to want Shahada preserved it from being deviated entirely, it has preserved it from the lower and the Ummah remaining at the lower levels, and it has saved the Ummah from remaining at the current status quo, and is pushing the Ummah to reach the level, the completion of God's plan for mankind on earth before the beginning of the realm of the hereafter.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء
إنه سلمي إلى العلياء فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report shows that 2021 continued the trend of annual climate devastation worldwide that is costing the global economy hundreds of billions of dollars as planet-heating emissions unleash exactly the kind of damage scientists have warned about for decades. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Coeli, journalist. This article is published under the heading World's Top 2021 Climate Disasters Cost Nearly $200 Billion, a study shows. Stay tuned for more. A new report
shows that 2021 continued the trend of annual climate devastation worldwide that is costing the global economy hundreds of billions of dollars as planet heating emissions unleash exactly the kind of damage scientists have warned about for decades. The cost of climate change have been grave this year, both in terms of eye-watering financial losses, but also in the death and displacement of people around the world. The new report by Christian Aid entitled Counting the Cost 2021, A Year of Climate Breakdown, analyzed the 15 most destructive climate disasters around the world over the last 12 months of the year and found that the top 10 events alone, based mostly on losses documented by insurance claims, came to approximately $170 billion. With the next five smaller events assessed by the study not included in that total, and recognizing that the real costs are much higher overall than those available by insurance figures alone, the true figure is certainly much higher. In the United States, the Texas winter storm earlier this year that cost $23 billion came in as the third most destructive event worldwide in 2021, while the devastation of Hurricane Ida, totaling $65 billion across numerous states, took the number one spot. At $43 billion, extreme floods that hit European nations over the summer collectively represented the second most costly disaster of the year. According to a statement by the group, some of the disasters in 2021 hit rapidly, like Cyclone Yaas, which struck India and Bangladesh in May and caused losses valued at $3 billion in just a few days. Other events took months to unfold, like the Paraná River drought in Latin America, which has seen the river, a vital part of the region's economy, at its lowest level in 77 years, and impacted lives and livelihoods in Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay. Four of the 10 most costly events took place in Asia, with floods and typhoons costing a combined $24 billion. But the impact of extreme weather was felt all over the world. Australia suffered floods in March, which displaced 18,000 people and saw damage worth $2.1 billion, while floods in Canada's British Columbia led to $7.5 billion in damage and 15,000 people having to flee their homes. Insurance and financial loss data on the recent tornadoes in the U.S. is incomplete, so is not included in this report, but may be included in next year's study. Christian Aid said that while the report focuses on financial costs, typically higher in richer countries due to higher property values and the existence of insurance markets, some of the most devastating extreme weather events in 2021 hit poorer nations, which have contributed little to causing climate change. Dr. Kat Kramer, the group's climate policy lead and author of the report, said dollar signs alone cannot calculate the losses caused by extreme weather. The costs of climate change have been grave this year, both in terms of eye-watering financial losses, but also in the death and displacement of people around the world, Kramer said, adding, be it storms and floods in some of the world's richest countries or droughts and heat waves in some of the poorest, the climate crisis hit hard in 2021. Kramer said that there was some progress made at the recent UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, but that the latest findings show it is clear that the world is not on track to ensure a safe and prosperous world. The figures for 2021 fall into a steady pattern in which the cost of extreme weather events and climate destruction continue to climb, just as climate scientists have long warned. The report notes that unless the world acts rapidly to cut emissions, these kinds of disasters are likely to worsen, and references data by UK-based insurance giant Aon, which show that 2021 is now likely to be the sixth time over the last decade in which global destruction from extreme weather events have crossed the $100 billion insured loss threshold. All six have happened since 2011, the report states, and 2020 will be the fourth in 5 years. Responding to the new report, Rachel Mander, a member of the Young Christian Climate Network and who took part in activism related to the COP26 summit in Glasgow, said, "Climate change will bankrupt us, and along the way, we will lose so much more than money. To avoid this eventuality, we need to take courageous action, making sure that the burden of costs are distributed and do not worsen global inequality, while also making activities which drive climate change more expensive."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
The great person
Zainab alayhi salam, showed two points. The first point is that women can be a vast ocean of patience and endurance. And the second point is that women can be a peak of wisdom and prudence. Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, demonstrated these in practice. And not just to those who were living in Kufa and Sham, she showed this to history and all of mankind. As for her patience and endurance, the patience and endurance that Zainab al-Kubra showed and the tragedies she faced cannot be described at all. Firstly, she showed great endurance in the face of the martyrdoms.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In about half a day or less than a day, 18 of her dear ones and relatives were martyred. One of these was her noble brother, God's proof on earth, the master of the martyrs, peace be upon him. These people were martyred in front of her eyes. Her two children were martyred as well. But she endured all of these. A mountain would collapse in the face of such tragedies. But Zainab al-Kubra was able to show patience and endurance and to carry out her subsequent duties with the inner strength that she possessed. If she had been impatient, wild, and shown restlessness, she would have not been able to deliver those speeches and to launch the great movement. So one point is her patience in the face of the martyrdoms. She also showed patience in the face of insults. A lady who had lived with dignity from the time she was born and whom everyone had held in high regard from her childhood to her adulthood was insulted by those thugs and ruffians in the Umayyad's army. But she was patient and did not break down.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.